Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're looking into something really intriguing, the ancient Medes and their, well, surprising connections to the origins and development of Christianity.
Yeah, it's a fascinating link, isn't it? Not one people immediately jump to.
Definitely not. I mean, you've got this ancient Iranian people, their empire powerful, what, over 2,500 years ago, long before Christianity even started.
That's right. There's no direct political interaction. The Median Empire and the early Christian church are separated by centuries.
But you're saying there are connections.
Oh, absolutely. When you sift through the historical analyses, the biblical texts themselves, later church history, you find these threads. It's more a story of lasting legacy, cultural echoes, maybe even shared ideas.
Okay. So our aim today is to kind of unpack how this ancient Iranian people, who were, let's face it, major players in reshaping the ancient Near East, how they left their mark on the world that Judaism and then Christianity emerged into.
Exactly. We'll look at where they pop up in history and scripture.
Right.
We'll see where Christianity later established itself in their old lands. And then there's this really interesting, though definitely debated, idea about religious influence.
Sounds good. So let's start at the beginning. Who exactly were the Medes?
Okay, so the Medes were an ancient people speaking an Indo-Iranian language. Their ancestors migrated onto the Iranian plateau, probably sometime in the second millennium BCE.
And they settled where exactly?
Primarily in the area that became known as Media, which is, broadly speaking, modern western and northwestern Iran.
And they started as tribes, but didn't stay that way.
No, not at all. Initially, they were organized into various tribes, but they faced a lot of external pressure, especially from the really powerful Neo-Assyrian Empire just to their west.
Ah, so the classic external threat pushing groups together.
Precisely. That pressure seems to have been a major catalyst. By the 7th century BCE, they were starting to coalesce to form a more unified and significant power.
And they played a key role in taking down those Assyrians, didn't they?
Absolutely pivotal role. Under a king named Cyaxares, a really important figure, they allied with the Babylonians.
Okay.
And together, they went after the Assyrian Empire. The campaign ended with the famous sack of Nineveh, the Assyrian capital, in 612 BCE.
Wow. That's a major historical event.
Huge.
Yeah.
It basically ended the Neo-Assyrian Empire and catapulted the Medes into becoming a major imperial power themselves.
But their time at the very top was relatively short.
Quite short, yeah. Their period of independent imperial dominance lasted maybe 60 years or so, from the early 7th century to the mid-6th century BCE.
Because then came the Persians.
Exactly. The last Median king, Astyages, was actually defeated by his own grandson, Cyrus the Great.
Cyrus the Great, founder of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, around 550 BCE.
That's the time frame, yes.
Yeah.
Around 550 BCE.
So Media gets absorbed into this new, massive Persian Empire, but it wasn't just, like, conquest and oblivion for them.
Not at all. And this is really key for understanding their lasting influence. The Achaemenid approach was often integration. Media became a hugely important satrapy, you know, a major province within the Persian Empire.
So Medes still had roles.
Absolutely. Many Medes held high-ranking positions in the government, in the military, Persian court life, their administration, even their style of dress was heavily influenced by Median customs.
Really? That's significant.
Oh, yes. It was so significant that for centuries afterwards, Greek writers often just referred to the whole Persian Empire or its people as the Medes, or use the terms interchangeably.
That tells you something about their perceived importance, doesn't it?
It really does. It shows how integrated and influential they remained within that larger Persian state long after their own empire was gone.
Okay, can you paint a picture of their homeland? What was Media like geographically?
Sure. It's a pretty diverse landscape. Mostly a high mountainous plateau in northwestern Iran. You've got the Elbrus Mountains to the north and the Zagros Range to the west, which kind of forms a barrier with Mesopotamia.
And their capital?
Their main center was Ecbatana, a very ancient city near modern Hamadan in Iran. It's actually mentioned in the Bible, too, but under the name Akhmeka. We'll probably come back to that.
Okay. And the terrain itself, mountains, you said?
Yeah. Rugged mountains, some arid steppe lands, but also some quite fertile valleys and plains suitable for agriculture.
What about their society? What did they do?
Well, based on what archaeology tells us and what outsiders wrote, it seems they were largely a pastoral society. Raising livestock was important.
Ah, weren't they famous for horses?
Very famous. Excellent horse breeders. Their cavalry horses were highly prized throughout the ancient world. But there was also agriculture, And we have evidence from sites like Tepe Nushiyan that they were skilled builders and really talented metalsmiths working in bronze and gold.
But we don't have much from their own perspective.
That's the tricky part. Indigenous media and written records are extremely scarce. So a lot of what we know comes from external sources. The Assyrians who fought them, the Greeks like Herodotus who wrote about them later.
Which must make understanding their religion a bit challenging too.
It does, but we have some pretty strong clues. They practiced an ancient Iranian religion, sharing common roots with the traditions we see in the Avesta, the Zoroastrian scriptures, and even the Vedic texts from India.
So what did that involve?
It definitely involved worshiping a pantheon of deities, probably nature gods initially, and a very strong reverence for natural elements. Fire seems to have been particularly central to their worship.
And this is where the Magi come in.
Exactly. The Magi were a specific priestly caste. Herodotus actually lists them as one of the six Median tribes. They were the ritual experts, interpreted dreams and omens, kind of the keepers of wisdom and religious lore.
And they continued to be important later under the Persians.
Very much so. They became influential figures in the Achaemenid and later Persian courts, often associated with astrology and what we might call magic. But their origins seem deeply rooted in Median religious practice.
What about specific deities? Do you know who they worshipped?
We see evidence pointing towards the worship of what are called Ahuric deities, figures associated with Asha, or truth and cosmic order. Chief among them would be Ahura Mazda, the wise lord.
Ahura Mazda, the central figure in Zoroastrianism.
Right. And also Mithra, a deity connected with covenants, contracts, and light. We even find names incorporating Mazda in Assyrian records, referring to people in the Median region as early as the 8th century BCE.
So this really does sound like it's leading towards Zoroastrianism.
It absolutely is. Many scholars describe the Median religion as a form of proto-Zoroastrianism, or perhaps an early stage in the development of the religion we call Zoroastrianism.
But the timing of Zarathustra himself is debated.
Hugely debated. Some scholars place him very early, maybe 1200 BCE or even earlier. Others put him much later, perhaps around the 6th or 7th century BCE, closer to the Median or early Persian period. But regardless of Zarathustra's exact dates, the Median religious landscape, with its focus on Ahura Mazda, the role of the Magi, the fire rituals, this was a crucial foundation. It heavily influenced the religious culture of the Persian Empire.
And that's the empire that comes into prolonged contact with the Jewish people after the Babylonian exile.
Precisely. Which sets the stage for potential interaction and influence.
Okay, so let's trace that interaction. How do the Medes actually appear in the Bible? Old Testament first.
Well, they show it pretty early, actually, but not in a great context for the Israelites. Back in the 8th century BCE, the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom of Israel.
Right, the deportation of the 10 tribes.
Exactly. And the Bible tells us where some of them were settled. 2 Kings says they were placed in Hala and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes.
Cities of the Medes. So that's the first point of contact, involuntary exile to Media.
Right. It marks the beginning of a significant Jewish diaspora, a presence in that region of the Iranian plateau.
Okay. But later on, the prophets start talking about the Medes differently.
They do. As Median power starts to rise and the Neo-Babylonian Empire becomes the big bully on the block after Assyria falls, prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah see the Medes in a new light.
As instruments of judgment.
Yes, specifically against Babylon. Isaiah says God is stirring up the Medes against them. Jeremiah talks about God rousing the spirit of the kings of the Medes to destroy Babylon.
So they're reflecting Media's growing military reputation at the time.
Exactly. It shows the Medes were recognized as a formidable force capable of challenging even the mighty Babylonians.
And then the book of Daniel seems to describe this actually happening.
It does, very vividly. You have the famous story of the writing on the wall at Belshazzar's feast.
Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin.
Right. And Daniel interprets part of it as meaning, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians.
Medes and Persians, together.
Yes. And then the text says that very night, Babylon falls and Darius the Mede receives the kingdom.
Now this Darius the Mede figure, he's a bit of a historical puzzle alongside Cyrus, isn't he?
He is. Identifying him precisely in relation to Cyrus the Great from non-biblical historical sources is a complex discussion among scholars. But within the biblical narrative, he represents the Median role in Babylon's downfall.
Okay. Even after the Persian Empire is fully established under Cyrus, the Medes still feature.
They do. which again reflects their ongoing importance.
Mm.
In the Book of Ezra, there's a search for Cyrus's original decree that allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple.
Right.
And where do they find it? At Akmatha, in the palace that is in the province of the Medes.
Akmatha, it's Ecbatana, the old Median capital.
Exactly. Shows it remained a major administrative center, probably a summer capital or archive location, for the Persian Empire.
And Esther also mentions them.
Frequently. The book repeatedly refers to the laws of the Persians and Medes, which cannot be altered, and lists the princes of Persia and Media. It consistently portrays them as integral partners in the empire, even if the Persians are usually listed first.
So a clear arc in the Old Testament, from a land of exile to prophesied conquerors to partners in empire. What about the New Testament? That's centuries later. Do they show up there?
They do. And at a really pivotal moment, the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem, right at the beginning of the book of Acts.
Pentecost. When the Holy Spirit comes and the apostles speak in tongues.
That's the one. Acts chapter 2 describes the diverse crowd that gathered, amazed because they heard the apostles speaking in their own native languages, and the list of people present begins. Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia.
Medes, again. But wait, like you said, the Median Empire was long gone by the first century CE.
Absolutely. By this time, the region of Media was under the control of the Parthian Empire. So these Medes mentioned in Acts couldn't have been citizens of an independent Median state.
So who were they?
Almost certainly. They were people from the geographical region known as Media. They could have been ethnic Medes, maybe converts to Judaism, proselytes. But perhaps more likely, they were descendants of those Jewish communities that had been living in Media since the Assyrian deportations centuries earlier, or Jews who had migrated there later.
Ah, so part of that established Jewish diaspora we talked about.
Exactly. The text even mentions that the crowd included both Jews and proselytes. So these were likely Jews or Jewish converts whose families had lived in the region of Media for generations and who had traveled to Jerusalem for the festival.
And what's the significance of them being there, hearing the gospel message at Pentecost?
Oh, it's hugely significant on a couple of levels. First, it powerfully illustrates the immediate universal reach of the Christian message. Right from day one, it's breaking down language and cultural barriers.
Mm.
Second, and really relevant for our topic, it highlights how early Christianity connected with and spread through the existing network of Jewish diaspora communities, especially those far to the east, beyond the Roman Empire's borders. These people from Media, hearing the news in Jerusalem, would have been among the very first potential carriers of that message back to their home regions.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Ah, wonderful. Perfect timing.
Let's see what we've got today. Okay. How's this cup? Oh, yes. Very good today. Nice and balanced, not too bitter. Perfect amount of sugar, I think. Just what we needed.
Excellent. Always appreciate Hannah's chai.
Right then. Nicely refreshed. Let's pick up that thread. We've got people from the region of Media present right at the birth of the church at Pentecost. What happens next? How does Christianity actually spread into those territories, the former Median lands?
Well, as we were just saying, that long-established Jewish diaspora was absolutely key. Their communities scattered across Persia, Mesopotamia, including Old Media. These provided the initial points of contact.
Natural starting points for missionaries.
Exactly. Early Christian missionaries, often Jewish Christians themselves, would naturally seek out synagogues and existing Jewish networks when they traveled east. It gave them a foothold, an audience that shared some common background.
So the seeds fell on somewhat prepared ground, you could say?
In a way, yes. And we have strong traditions, apostolic traditions, pointing eastward. Figures like the Apostle Thomas are strongly associated with missions to Parthia in India. Thaddeus, also known as Aday in the Syriac tradition, and Bartholomew are linked with evangelizing Mesopotamia and the regions bordering Media.
Where did early Christian centers emerge?
Key early centers were often in Mesopotamia, just west of Media proper. Places like Edessa became incredibly important hubs for Syriac Christianity. That's Christianity used in the Syriac language, a dialect of Aramaic. Arbela in Adiabene, east of the Tigris, was another early center. From these places, the faith seems to have radiated outwards.
Including into the old Median territories.
Yes, over time, definitely. By the 3rd and 4th century CE, we start seeing solid evidence of organized Christian communities with bishops popping up across this wider region. And that explicitly includes areas historically associated with Media around Lake Ermia, for instance, near the Caspian Sea.
Any specific examples?
Yeah, there's a really interesting historical detail. We know that a bishop named Mar Yochana from Ermia actually attended the famous First Council of Nicaea back in 325 CE.
Nicaea, the one convened by Emperor Constantine.
The very same. The fact that a bishop from the Urmia region deep in former Median territory, well within the Persian sphere, was present at Nicaea, shows these communities existed, were organized, and were connected, at least initially, to the wider Christian world in the Roman Empire.
And we also have Christian writers from the Persian Empire around this time.
We do. Figures like Aphrahat, known as the Persian sage, was writing important Christian theological works in Syriac from within the Sasanian Persian Empire in the 4th century.
Now, the form of Christianity that really took root here developed its own distinct character, right? The Church of the East.
That's right. This eastern branch of Christianity flourishing in the Persian Empire and beyond is known as the Church of the East. It used Syriac as its liturgical and theological language.
And it became quite independent.
Yes. It formally organized itself at a council held in the Persian capital, Seleucia Ctesiphon, in 410 CE. And later, in 424 CE, it declared its administrative independence from the churches in the Roman Empire. Partly, this is theological, but also partly political, to ease suspicions from the Persian rulers.
It's sometimes called the Nestorian Church, though that's complicated.
It is often called that historically, yes, due to later theological controversies involving Nestorius. But the church itself predates that controversy, and many scholars and members prefer the term Church of the East.
And this Church of the East, its reach became enormous, didn't it?
Absolutely vast. By the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, it had spread incredibly far. Dioceses and bishops stretched all across Mesopotamia, throughout the Persian Empire, deep into Central Asia, along the Silk Road, established communities in India, and famously reached the Tang Dynasty capital in China by the 7th century.
Wow. And within Persia itself, did it have a strong presence in those old Median lands?
Oh, yes. Records from the Church of the East's own synods, their council meetings, in the 6th century explicitly list bishoprics in regions corresponding to ancient Media, including areas like Azerbaijan. So there was a well-established, organized Christian presence there for centuries.
How did these Christians fare under Persian rule? The dominant religion there was Zoroastrianism, wasn't it?
It was, and Zoroastrianism was often closely tied to the Sasanian state. So the experience of Christians varied quite a bit.
Depending on?
A lot depended on the political climate, especially the relationship between the Persian Empire and its big rival, the Roman Byzantine Empire to the west.
Ah, so when Persia and Rome were at war?
Exactly. Christians in Persia could suddenly be viewed with great suspicion. They might be accused of having loyalty to the Christian Roman Emperor rather than the Persian King of Kings. This led to periods of quite severe persecution, like under King Shapur II in the 4th century, where many Christians were martyred.
And the Zoroastrian priests?
The Zoroastrian clergy could also be quite hostile at times towards minority religions that were seen as challenging their authority or the state religion. But it wasn't constant persecution. There were also long periods of relative tolerance and coexistence.
Did the Church of the East's independence help?
It sometimes did. By emphasizing its distinctness from the Church and the Roman Empire, particularly after the major theological splits of the 5th century, the Church of the East could sometimes demonstrate its loyalty to the Persian throne and gain more acceptance. Despite all the challenges, it was an incredibly resilient and missionary-focused church.
Okay, so we've covered the Medes in the Bible, both Old and New Testaments, and the later establishment of Christianity in their historical homeland. That leaves the third connection you mentioned, the really complex one about potential religious influence.
Right. This is probably the most profound, but also the most debated way the Median legacy might connect to Christianity. It's about the potential influence of Zoroastrianism, which, as we discussed, has deep Median roots on the development of Judaism during the Second Temple period.
The period after the Babylonian exile when Jews were living under Persian rule for centuries.
Exactly. This long period of close contact between Jewish culture and Persian culture, which was heavily influenced by Zoroastrianism, created an environment where ideas could potentially flow back and forth.
And the argument is that Zoroastrian ideas influenced Judaism and therefore influenced Christianity, which emerged from that Judaism.
That's the core hypothesis argued by many scholars. They point to some pretty striking similarities between certain Zoroastrian concepts and ideas that seem to become much more prominent or develop in new ways within Jewish thought during and after the Persian period.
You said it's debated. Why? What makes it hard to pin down?
Several things. We already mentioned the difficulty in dating Zarathustra and the final compilation of the Avesta, the Zoroastrian scriptures. Parts are ancient, but much was written down quite late, some even after Christianity was established. So proving who had an idea first can be tricky.
Okay. What else?
Well, there's also the possibility of parallel development. Maybe both traditions developed similar ideas independently because they were grappling with similar human questions. Or perhaps influence flowed both ways. Or maybe Jewish thinkers encountered these ideas but consciously adapted or even rejected them, a process sometimes called disidentification, engaging with an idea to define yourself against it.
So it's not a simple case of borrowing?
Rarely is with cultural exchange. It's usually much more complex. But the parallels are there, and they're worth examining.
Okay, let's get into those parallels. What are the key concepts where scholars see potential Zoroastrian influence?
One major area is dualism, the concept of a cosmic struggle between good and evil.
How does that look in Zoroastrianism?
At its heart, Zoroastrianism posits this fundamental conflict between Ahura Mazda, the supreme god of goodness, light, and truth, and an opposing force, Angromenu or Ahriman, representing evil, darkness, and lies. History, the world, even the individual human heart is seen as a battleground for these two forces.
And the comparison is with Jewish and Christian thought.
Right. While earlier Israelite religion certainly acknowledged evil, it strongly emphasized God's absolute sovereignty. But in later Jewish writings, especially from the Second Temple period, think of texts found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, there's a much more pronounced focus on a cosmic battle between forces of light and darkness, spirits of truth and deceit.
And Christianity inherits that.
Very much so. The struggle between God and Satan, angels and demons, light and darkness, is absolutely central to Christian theology and worldview.
But there's a key difference.
A crucial distinction that most scholars maintain. In Judaism and Christianity, God remains absolutely supreme and sovereign. Satan, however powerful, is ultimately a created being, a rebel, not a co-eternal, co-equal opposing principle like Angromenu is often understood in Zoroastrianism. But the intensification of dualistic language and cosmic struggle in post-exilic Judaism is what leads some to see Zoroastrian influence during that period of contact.
Okay, that's dualism. What's another area?
Eschatology believes about the end times, the final destiny of humanity and the world.
Zoroastrianism had developed ideas about this.
Oh, very developed. Zoroastrian tradition includes belief in a future bodily resurrection of the dead, a final judgment where all souls are assessed based on their life's deeds.
A judgment. How did that work?
There's the concept of the Chinvat Bridge, a bridge of judgment that the soul must cross. For the righteous, it's wide and easy, leading to paradise. For the wicked, it narrows to a razor's edge, and they fall into a place of punishment, a hell.
Paradise and hell.
Yes. And ultimately, a belief in a final renovation of the universe called Frashokrati, where evil is finally defeated and the world is restored to its original perfect state. They also expected a future savior figure, the Saoxiant, who would play a key role in this final victory.
And the word paradise.
That word itself is actually a loan word from Old Persian, paradesa, originally meaning a walled enclosure or garden. It came into Greek and then into biblical language.
Fascinating. And how does this compare to Jewish and Christian eschatology?
Well, ideas like bodily resurrection, a final judgment based on deeds, and a clear distinction between an afterlife of reward, heaven, paradise, and punishment, held Kenna, become much more prominent and clearly articulated in Jewish literature during the Second Temple period. Think of the visions in the Book of Daniel or texts like the Book of Enoch.
And for Christianity.
These concepts are absolutely fundamental, aren't they? The resurrection of Jesus is the cornerstone. Belief in a future general resurrection of all people, a final judgment, eternal life in heaven or punishment in hell, and the return of Christ as the Messiah to establish God's kingdom, these are core doctrines. The parallels in the structure of these end-time beliefs are striking.
They really are. Okay, one more area you mentioned was angelology and demonology.
Yes, the understanding of spiritual beings, both good and evil. Zoroastrianism has quite an elaborate cosmology. Serving Ahura Mazda are benevolent spiritual beings, the Amatius Bentus, often seen as personifications of divine attributes, perhaps loosely analogous to archangels, and numerous Yazatas, other divine beings worthy of worship.
And on the other side?
Opposing them are the Daivas, considered malevolent spirits or demons, led by Angromenu. There are also other personified evils like Druj, the lie. One specific figure is Eshmadeva, the demon of wrath or fury.
Eshmadeva, does that connect to anything in Jewish tradition?
Some scholars propose a connection between Eshmadeva and the figure of Asmodeus, a prominent demon mentioned in the Jewish book of Tobit, which is generally dated to the Second Temple period, likely during or after the Persian era.
Interesting. And how did angels and demons develop in Jewish and Christian thought?
Well, angels certainly appear in earlier parts of the Hebrew Bible. The Second Temple period sees a significant development. We get more named angels, like Michael and Gabriel, a clearer hierarchy of angelic beings, and also a much more defined figure of Satan, or Belial in some texts, as the leader of opposing demonic forces.
So a more systematized view.
Exactly. This more developed angelology and demonology, which becomes absolutely central to the New Testament and Christian tradition, is another area where some scholars suggest influence from the complex spiritual world of Zoroastrianism encountered during the Persian period.
So putting it all together, even with the debates about how it happened, direct influence, parallel development, something else, the historical context is key.
Absolutely. The Persian Empire, deeply influenced by its Median heritage and Zoroastrianism, provided the specific historical and cultural environment in which Second Temple Judaism was developing and evolving. And it was this form of Judaism, shaped within that Perso-Median milieu, that formed the immediate background and matrix from which Christianity emerged.
It really forces you to think about religious history less as separate streams and more as interconnected currents, doesn't it?
It does. Traditions interact. They respond to each other. They borrow. They adapt. They redefine themselves in conversations, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly. The Medes, through their empire, their integration into Persia, and their religious legacy, are undeniably part of that wider ancient Near Eastern conversation.
Okay, so let's try to synthesize this. The connection between the ancient Medes and Christianity, it's not a straight line, not direct interaction between the Median state and the early church.
Not at all. It's woven from several different threads. First, you have their actual explicit appearances within the biblical narrative itself.
Right, the place of exile for Israelites, the prophesied instrument against Babylon, the partners with the Persians and Daniel, Ezra, Esther.
And then, crucially, people from Media being present right there in Jerusalem at Pentecost, hearing the gospel at its very beginning. That's the biblical thread.
Then there's the geographical thread.
Yes. The fact that Christianity, particularly in the form of the Church of the East, later put down deep roots and flourished for centuries in the very lands where the Medes had lived and ruled, bishoprics, communities, a lasting presence.
And finally, the most complex thread, the intellectual or theological one.
Exactly. That ongoing scholarly discussion about the potential influence of the Median-rooted religion, Zoroastrianism, on the evolution of Jewish thought during the critical Second Temple period, particularly regarding ideas like dualism, eschatology, angels, and demons, ideas that then became foundational for Christianity.
So it's a story that shows how the influence of a people and their culture can ripple outwards long after their political power has faded.
Precisely. The Medes' legacy wasn't erased. It became part of the fabric of the Persian Empire, and through that, part of the broader cultural and religious environment of the ancient Near East, an environment that shaped the world into which Christianity was born and spread. It highlights the interconnectedness of it all.
Which really leaves us with something to think about, doesn't it? When we understand these deep, often indirect, historical and intellectual connections, like the multifaceted legacy of the Medes, how does that change how we appreciate the unique path, but also the shared heritage and the complex evolution of major religious traditions like Christianity?
It adds layers, definitely. It encourages a more nuanced view, seeing traditions not in isolation, but as part of a much larger dynamic historical process.
Well, this has been a really illuminating exploration into these surprising connections. Thank you for walking us through it.
My pleasure. It's a truly fascinating intersection of history and religion.